Thank you all for coming. This is lovely. I really am grateful. I, Sam Pulsiver, am the man who accidentally burned down the Emily Dickinson House in Amherst, Massachusetts, and who in the process killed two people, for which I spent 10 years in prison and, as letters from scholars of American literature tell me, for which I will continue to pay a high price long into the not-so-sweet hereafter. This story is locally well-known, and so I won't go into it here. It's probably enough to say that in the Massachusetts Mount Rushmore of big, gruesome tragedy, there are the Kennedys and Lizzie Borden and her axe and the burning witches at Salem, and then there's me. So anyway, I served my time, and since the sentencing judge took mercy on me, I served my time at the minimum security prison up at Holyoke. At Holyoke, there were bond analysts and lawyers and day traders and city managers and school administrators, all of them caught with their hands in the till and nothing at all like me, an 18-year-old accidental arsonist and murderer with blood and soot in his hands and a heavy heart and plenty to learn and no high school diploma. I flung in and tried. I took a biweekly self-improvement seminar called The College of Me, in which I learned the life-changing virtues of patience, hard work, and positive attitude, and in which I earned my GED. I also hung around this group of high-stepping bond analysts from Boston who were in the clink for insider trading. While they were inside, the bond analysts had set out to write their fond, freewheeling memoirs about their high crimes and misdemeanors and all the cashish. That's the way they talked. They had made while screwing old people out of their retirement funds and kids out of their college savings. These guys seemed to know everything, the whole vocabulary of worldly gain and progress, so I paid extra attention during their memoir brainstorming sessions, listened closely to their debates over how much the reading public did or did not need to know about their tortured childhoods in order to understand why they needed to make so much money in the manner in which they made it. I took notes as they divided the world between those who had stuff taken from them and those who took. Those who did bad things in a good way, gracefully, effortlessly, and those bumblers who bumbled their way through life. Bumblers, I said. Yes, they said, or one of them did, those who bumble. Give me an example, I said, and they stared at me with those blue steel stares they were born with and didn't need to learn at Choate or Andover, and they stared those stares until I realized that I was an example. And so this is what I learned from them, that I was a bumbler. I resigned myself to the fact and had no illusions about striving to be something else, a bond analyst or memoirist, for instance, and just got on with it. Life, that is. I learned something from everyone, is the point, even while I was fending off the requisite cell block buggerer, a gentle but crooked corporate accountant, Arthur Anderson, who was just finding his true sexual self and who told me in a cracked, aching voice that he wanted me. Wanted me, that is, until I told him I was a virgin, which I was, and which, for some reason, made him not want me anymore, which meant that people did not want to sleep with 28-year-old male virgins, which I thought was useful to know. Finally, I learned to play basketball from this black guy named Terrell, which was one of the big joys of my life in prison, which ended badly. Terrell, who had written checks to himself when he was the Worcester City Treasurer, was in prison for the last three of my 10 years, and whenever he would beat me in one-on-one, this wasn't often, even when I was first learning to play, because although he was very strong, Terrell was also shorter than I was and about as sleek as a fire hydrant. Plus, he was twice my age, and his knees were completely shot and would crack like dry wood when he ran. But whenever he did beat me, Terrell would yell out, "I'm a grown-ass man." That sounded good, and so after our last game, which I won easily, I also yelled out, "I'm a grown-ass man," and Terrell thought I was mocking him, so he started hitting me around the head, and since I get passive in the face of true anger, I just stood there and took Terrell's abuse and didn't try to defend myself. As the guards dragged him to solitary, he promised that he would beat on me a little more once he got out, which he shouldn't have, because, of course, the guards that gave him more solitary than they might have otherwise. By the time Terrell got out, I'd already been released from prison and was home, living with my parents. That didn't work out too well, living with my parents. For one, my burning down the Emily Dickinson house caused them some real heartbreak, because my mother was a high school English teacher. My father, an editor for the university press in town, and beautiful words really mattered to them. They didn't care anything for movies or TV, but you could always count on a good poem to make them cry or sigh meaningfully. For another, their neighbors in Amherst weren't exactly happy that I'd burned down the town's most famous house and killed two of its citizens in the bargain, so they took it out on my parents. People never had trouble finding our old creaking house on Chicopee Street. It was always the one with the driveway that had been spray-painted "murderer," which I understand, or "fascist," which I don't, or with some quote from Dickinson herself that seemed to promise vengeance, but you could never tell exactly what the vengeance might be, because there were a lot of words, and the spray painter always got sloppy and illegible from fatigue, or maybe over emotion. It only got worse when I went home after prison. There was some picketing by the local arts council, and some unwelcome, unflattering news coverage, and neighborhood kids who cared nothing about Emily Dickinson or her house started egging the place and draping our noble birches with toilet paper, and for a while there, it was like Halloween every day. Then things got really serious, and someone slashed every tire on my parents' Volvo, and once, in a fit of anger or grief, someone hurled a Birkenstock through one of our bay windows. It was a man's right shoe, size 12. All of this happened within the first month of my return home. At the end of the month, my parents suggested I move out. I remember it was August because the three of us were sitting on our front porch and the neighbors' flags were out, caught between the 4th of July and Labor Day and in full flutter, and the light was spectral coming through the maple and birch leaves, and it was all very pretty. You can imagine how much my parents' request that I leave home wounded me, even though the college of me said that life after prison wouldn't be easy and that I shouldn't fool myself into thinking otherwise. But where should I go? I asked them. You could go anywhere, my mother said. Back then, I thought she was the harder parent of the two and had had high hopes for me, so the disappointment weighed on her more heavily. I remember that my mother was a dry well at my trial when the jury brought back the verdict, although my father had wept loudly and wetly, and he was starting to cry now, too. I hated to see them like this, one cold, the other weepy. There was a time when I was six and they taught me to skate on a pond at the Amherst Public Golf Course. The ice was so thick and clean and glimmery that the fish and errant golf balls were happy to be frozen in it. The sun was streaking the falling snow, making it less cold. When I finally made it around the perimeter of the pond without falling, my mother and father gave me a long ovation. They were a united front of tickled, proud parenthood. Now, those times were gone. Gone, gone, forever gone. Maybe you could go to college, Sam, my father said after he'd gotten a hold of himself. That's a good idea, my mother said. We'd be happy to pay for it. Okay, I said, because I was looking at them closely, really scrutinizing them for the first time since I'd been home from prison, and I could see what I'd done to them. Before I'd burned down the Emily Dickinson house, they seemed to be normal, healthy, somewhat happy Americans who took vacations and gardened and who'd weathered a rough patch or two. When I was a boy, my father left us for 3 years, and after he left us, my mother started telling me tall tales about the Emily Dickinson house, and all of this is part of the longer, larger story that I will get to and couldn't avoid even if I wanted. Now, they looked like skeletons dressed in corduroy and loafers. Their eyes were sunken and wanting to permanently retreat all the way back into their skulls. A few minutes earlier, I'd been telling them about my virginity and the lecherous Arthur Anderson accountant. My parents, as far as I knew back then, were both modest Yankees who didn't like to hear about anyone's private business, but the college of me insisted that it was healthy and necessary to tell the people we love everything. Now, I was regretting it. Why do we hurt our parents the way we do? There's no way to make sense of it, except as practice for then hurting our children the way we do. Okay, I said again, I'll go to college, and then I love you both. Oh, us too, my father said, and then started weeping again. We certainly do, my mother said, and then to my father, Bradley, quit crying. Later that night, after my mother had gone to sleep, my father came into my room without knocking, stood over my bed, then leaned down, either to say something to me or to see if I was asleep. I wasn't asleep. I was thinking hopeful thoughts about my future, of how I would go to college and make a clean, honest, painless life for myself, and how proud my parents would be once I'd made it. My father, bent over at the waist the way he was, looked like a crane there to either lift me up with its hook or wreck me with its heavy ball. Come downstairs, my father whispered, his face close to mine in the darkness. I want to show you something. I got out of bed, followed him downstairs. My father walked into his study, which was, like most of the rooms in the house, lined floor to ceiling with overflowing bookshelves. He sat in a chair, opened the end table drawer next to him, pulled out a Converse shoebox, the sort of box in which you kept your old photos or Christmas cards, and handed it to me. I took the lid off the box and saw that there were envelopes inside, envelopes slid open with a letter opener. The envelopes were addressed to me, all of them. The letters were still inside the envelopes, so I took them out and read them. There were at least 100 letters. Some of them, as I mentioned, were from scholars of American literature, damning me to hell, etc. There was something underwhelming about scholarly hate mail, the sad literary allusions, the refusal to use contractions, and so I didn't pay much attention to those letters at all. I'd also received several letters from your ordinary arson enthusiasts, which were minor variations in the burn, baby, burn theme. These particular letters didn't affect me much either. The fact that the world was full of kooks wasn't any bigger news than the fact that the world was full of bores. But there were other letters. They were from all over New England and from beyond. From Portland, Bristol, Boston, Burlington, Derry, Chicopee, Hartford, Providence, Pittsfield. From towns and cities in New York and Pennsylvania, too. They were all from people who lived near the homes of writers and who wanted me to burn those houses down. A man in New London, Connecticut, wanted me to burn Eugene O'Neill's home because what an awful drunk O'Neill was. And what a bad example he set for the school children visiting his home, who needed, after all, more positive role models in the here and now. A woman in Lenox, Massachusetts, wanted me to torch Edith Wharton's house because visitors to Wharton's house parked in front of the woman's mailbox, and because Wharton was always, in her opinion, something of a whiner and a phony. A dairy farmer in Cooperstown, New York, wanted me to pour gasoline down the chimney of the James Fenimore Cooper house because the dairy farmer couldn't stand the thought of someone being from such a rich family when his family was so awfully poor. "I've had it harder than Cooper ever did," the man wrote. "That family's got money up to here, and they charge $10 admission to their home, and people pay it. Won't you please burn that son of a bitching house right to the ground for us? We'll pay, too. I'll sell some of our herd if I have to. I look forward to your response." There were more letters, and they all wanted the same thing. All of them wanted me to burn down the houses of a variety of dead writers: Mark Twain, Louisa May Alcott, Robert Lowell, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Some of the correspondents wanted me to burn down the homes of writers I'd never even heard of. All of the letter writers were willing to wait for me to get out of prison, and all of them were willing to pay me. "Wow," I said to my father when I was done reading. He hadn't said anything in a while. It was interesting. When my mother was around, my father always appeared weak-minded and soft-hearted, a slight, unnecessary, and mostly foolish human being. But now, in that room with those letters, he seemed to me wise, silent, and massive, like a Buddha in wire-rimmed glasses. I felt the enormity of the situation in my throat and face and elsewhere. "Why didn't you tell me about those letters while I was in prison?" I asked him. He looked at me, but didn't say anything. This was a test of sorts, because this, of course, is what the wise do. They test the wise to make them less so. "You wanted to protect me," I said, and he nodded. It heartened me to know that I could give him the right answer, and so I persisted. "You wanted to protect me from these people who thought I was an arsonist." My father couldn't leave this one alone. He went into a violent struggle with his better judgment, wrestling with his mouth as he started and stopped himself from speaking a dozen times. It was like watching Atlas gear up to hoist that big boulder we now live on. But finally, my father got it out and said sadly, so sadly, "Sam, you are an arsonist." Oh, how that hurt. But it was true, and I needed to hear it, needed my father to tell it to me, just as we need all our fathers to tell us the truth, as someday I'll tell it to my children, too. And someday, my children will do to me what I did to my father. They will deny it, the truth. "You're wrong," I said. "I'm not an arsonist. I'm a college student." I put the top back on the box of letters, handed it back to him, and left before he could say anything else. When I got back in bed, I made myself promise to never think of the letters again. "Forget about them," I commanded myself. I thought I could do it, too. After all, wasn't this what college was all about? Emptying your mind of the things you didn't want to remember and filling your mind up with the new things before the old, unwanted things could find their way back in? I left for college 2 weeks later. It was 10 years before I saw my parents, 10 years before I reread those letters, 10 years before I met some of the people who'd written the letters, 10 years before I found out things about my parents that I'd never suspected and never wanted to know, 10 years before I went back to prison, 10 years before any of what happened happened. Thank you. I'm not done, though. We were talking before the reading. I swear a little bit, and the usual passage I read from the novel is, there are only a few of them, but they're the ones where, let me tell you, he gets out of prison, as you know, he gets married, he has kids, he doesn't tell them about anything that he's done. He lies to them about everything. And then his wife finds out he's been lying, and he gets exiled back to his parents' house, and these other houses get burned down. The houses that people want him to burn down, but he doesn't burn them down himself, or so he says. And I read a lot of the set pieces, so I tend to read the the set piece where he goes to investigate who's burned down the Mark Twain house, who's burned down the Edward Bellamy house, the Robert Frost place. And those are the only ones just filled with obscenity. And I'm afraid if I read them here, I'm going to violate some outdoor obscenity code. At least Louise told me I would. So I'm going to read a chapter I've never read before. It's a chapter, he lives in this, he and his wife and his kids has moved to this suburb, this subdivision outside of Amherst called Camelot. And it's the second chapter. I got one left. The drinker in the audience is probably laughing at him. I'm going to read a bit from that chapter. First, there was the man, the son whose mother, she was one of the Emily House tour guides, and father happened, unknown to me, to be sharing a private after-hours moment on Emily Dickinson's bed when I accidentally burned the house down and killed them those many years before. He showed up in early November on a Saturday, which was about right, since nothing ever happened in Camelot during the week. During the week, everyone worked and went to bed early and got up early, and you couldn't clip your toenails on your front porch for fear of bothering someone with the noise. Weekends were different, our chance to prove that we could pour gas out of a spout and into a hole and pull a cord and make noise and then cut some grass. I'd just finished cutting mine. There wasn't much to say about it. It was short and I'd cut it with a mower, the kind of mower all my neighbors used, one of those self-powered space-age things where you stood on a platform and steered with levers at the handles. The mower moved so fast that it seemed to hover and basically did all the work for you. But still, I managed to work up a sweat while riding it, which caused me to take off my shirt, which got me in some trouble with my neighbors, my male neighbors. No women mowed lawns in Camelot. In this, we were like the Muslims, who all wore big padded recording studio-type headphones while they mowed, and also huge floppy hats and safety goggles and heavy-duty gardening gloves and long-sleeves Oxford shirts and paint-spattered khaki pants tucked into the top of work boots. Except for tiny swatches of upper cheek and neck, there was no skin visible on them at all. My bare-chestedness ran counter to some unwritten subdivision behavioral code, and it heard me some hard, disgusted stares from my neighbors. Every Saturday, I reminded myself to remain fully clothed, but once I started sweating, I could never remember to keep my shirt on, and in this way fell into my own little unintentional piece of rebellion. I was like the patriot who kept forgetting not to dump the king's tea into the harbor. This is not to say that because I sweated and took off my shirt and unintentionally rebelled, that I was better than my neighbors. I wasn't. I can't remember any of their names, but they were all good people. I hope they're well. I was sitting on my front porch, which was really just a concrete slab that we called a porch because we like to sit on it. I just turned off my mower, the roar of it still in my ears, and so I didn't hear the son of my accidental victims drive up, park his Jeep on the street, then walk up the driveway. Didn't know he was there at all until he was right in front of me. His name was Thomas Coleman, although I didn't know this yet. I was looking down in thought when he came up to where I was sitting, and so I saw his feet before I saw the rest of him. He was wearing hiking boots, the waterproof kind. "Are you Sam Pulsiver?" he asked. At the sound of the voice, a stillborn lump caught in my throat because I thought I knew who this voice and those feet belonged to. I was sure it was a reporter. I hadn't spoken to one in years, but I remembered the way they talked, always leading you away from your version of the truth and toward theirs. I remember their tiny spiral-bound notebooks and the way they looked so eager to ask you their questions to which they already knew the answers and so disappointed in the way you answered them. "Yes, I'm Sam," I said, and then raised my eyes to look at the reporter and found that he wasn't one, which I could tell at first glance. For one thing, no visible notebook. For another, no pen or pencil. And unlike the reporters I remembered, now that he'd asked his question and I'd answered it, he didn't seem inclined to ask another one, but instead just stood there and looked at me. I led him and looked back, too. He was not so tall, but he was skinny, real skinny. I could tell this even under all his clothes. He was wearing lined jeans. I could see the red flannel peeking out from underneath the cuffs and over the hiking boots, and a flannel shirt over which he wore a corduroy shirt, over which he wore a fleece vest, even though it was freakishly warm out for November. And if I'd known the guy better, I would have told him that if he ate more, he wouldn't have to wear so many clothes. I was a walking shirtless advertisement for that truth. And then there was his face, which was gaunt and pale, so pale, and pockmarked, too. If my face were was the flaming sun, then his was the cratered moon. "I'm Thomas Coleman," he said. "Okay, nice to meet you," I said, and stuck out my hand, which Thomas didn't take. His jaw started pumping a little bit, as if working up some saliva to spit on the hand I offered to him, and so I took it back. "You don't recognize my name, do you?" he said. And he was right in that. There was nothing, no bells or whistles. Right then, my memory was a happy, empty, echoing place. Well, I do recognize the name Thomas, I said, trying to be polite, but then again, it's a pretty common name. Which it was, and I meant this seriously, but he took it as sarcasm. I could tell by the way his jaw started working double time. He was an angry man, all right, and maybe that's why he was so skinny, chewing so hard in his anger that he didn't have the time or the energy or the appetite to chew on anything else. Thomas Coleman, he finally said. My parents were Linda and David Coleman. You killed them in the Emily Dickinson House fire. Oh, I said, since I didn't know what else to say, and then, because this suddenly seemed like a more formal occasion, I put my shirt on. Once I was fully clothed and out of nervousness, I went into a flurry of greeting. I shook his hand. I went out and grabbed it this time. There was no stopping me. Slapped his back and asked, how are you? So good to see you. How have you been? And so on. All this may seem horribly inappropriate, but what should I have done? There is no etiquette book for this sort of thing. I was writing it as I stood there. Besides, Thomas didn't seem to think that I'd been so inappropriate. Maybe after you've accidentally killed someone's parents, every other offense is minor by comparison. His face even seemed to get a little color when I asked him if he wanted a drink, beer, juice. I told Thomas he could have whatever he wanted, although it may have been the glow off my own face illuminating his pockmarks. I was really giving off some heat and light. I probably could have powered the whole subdivision if there had been a blackout. I didn't explain. He's got this incredibly red face that he goes on and on and on about. I act like I don't make him go on and on about it, but he's got a red face. Do you recognize my name now, he asked. Do you recognize my parents' names? Sort of, I said, even though I didn't, not really. And even at the trial, I tried hard not to know their names, as my future seemed a lot more likely a prospect if I forgot the details of my past. I don't really remember the whole thing all that well, I told him, which, as I've mentioned, is a talent of mine and was true besides. Even now, with Thomas in front of me, the fire and the smoke and his parents' burning bodies were so far away, they seemed like someone else's problem, which is awfully mean to say, and in that way, perfectly consistent with most true things. Sort of, he repeated. A little more color crept into Thomas's face when he said this, and I could already see I was doing his health some good, and if this kept up, I might even get him to eat something. Sort of? Don't you even feel a little bit bad about killing my parents? It was an accident, I said. Thomas drew himself up at this and made a face, and in his defense, I could see how he didn't believe me. Because if you said over and over again about the fire you'd set and the people you'd killed, it was an accident. It sounded as though you were whining. And if it sounded as though you were whining, it also sounded as though it wasn't an accident. And then it didn't matter whether it really was an accident or not. If you said about something terrible you'd done, it was an accident, you sounded like a coward and a liar, both. I sympathize with Thomas completely, but still, the truth is the truth is the truth. It was an accident, I said, again, again. There's no such thing as an accident, Thomas said. Wow, it's funny you say that, I told him. Anne-Marie's his wife. Anne-Marie had said the same thing many a time. In our life together, I ruined more than one surprise party and leaned over backward and broke more than a few of our neighbors' cherished heirloom chairs and told far too many ethnic jokes in the company of someone of that same ethnicity. And after each of these unconscious, unpremeditated bumblings, Anne-Marie accused me of doing it intentionally. That this wasn't an accident, she'd say. You did it on purpose. And I always told her, I didn't. I don't. And she'd say, there is no such thing as an accident. And I'd say, there is. But maybe there wasn't. I could see what she was talking about. And Thomas, too. I miss my parents so much, Thomas said. It's been 20 years since you killed them, and I still miss them so fucking much. There's still some swearing in here, apparently. Oh, I know you do, I told him. I was feeling empathy for him deep down in my gut, and his missing his parents made me miss mine, too, and in a way we were both orphans and in the same boat. Hey, listen, I said, are you sure you don't want a drink or something? Because I was still thirsty from the lawn mowing, and besides, I was really starting to feel close to him and in his debt for doing what I'd done to his parents in his life and would have gotten him anything he wanted. No, he said, and then, do you know what they did to me in school? Wait a minute, I said, who? When did this happen? What school? Because I need to know the specifics of the story if I'm going to care. I mean, really care about it. As a child, I could never feel much for the three little pigs in their houses because I didn't know whether the houses, straw, brick, or otherwise, were in a town or a city or a village, or whether that municipality had a name, and without one, I just couldn't bring myself to care. This is at Williston Country Day, Thomas said, right after you killed my parents. He said this slowly, as if I were somewhat slow myself, and so I would get it all down and understand, which I appreciated. The other kids, students, friends even, they made fun of my parents. "You're kidding me," I said. "That's awful, Thomas. Those were no friends." "They were. They made fun of the way my parents died, you know, in bed." He stumbled over these last words and was obviously still in a lot of pain and haunted by it, the poor guy. "For a long time," he went on, "I was ashamed of them, hated them because of what they were doing when you killed them." "That's understandable," I said. "There was a girl in my class whose parents died in a car wreck," he said. "They were both decapitated. I was jealous of her. For a long time, I wished my parents had died like that." "Totally understandable," I said. "For a long time," he said, sucking in a big wet breath, "I wanted to kill myself." "Don't say that, Thomas. Don't even think it," I said. Again, I would have done anything for the guy. If he'd brought out the razor blades to slit his wrists, I would have ripped my shirt into bandages. If he'd had pills and swallowed them, I would have pumped his stomach, even without the proper know-how or medical equipment. I wanted to save him just like I wanted to save myself, I suppose. In this way, I was like the mirror who wanted to save the guy looking into it, and thus save the mirror image, too. It was a complicated emotional response, all right, and I'm not sure I understood it myself, which is how I knew it was so complicated. "And when I didn't want to kill myself," Thomas said, looking at me from underneath his eyebrows, which were blonde and thin like his hair, "I wanted to kill you." "Well," I said, because I didn't have a response to this except to say that I was glad he hadn't. Killed me, that is. "Don't worry," he said, although he said this in a deep, dark tone of voice that belied his skinniness and suggested that maybe I should worry. "My shrink talked me out of killing you." "You have a shrink?" "I've had a bunch." Thomas said this as if he were weary of his sadness, as if grief were a Halloween costume he still had on after the holiday and he wanted to take it off but couldn't, and suddenly I had a very clear vision of his life, which I had helped to make for him just as surely as I had helped make my own. I could see him going from shrink to shrink, and except for those shrinks and his grief and his awful past, he was all alone in the world. I doubted he had his own wife and kids waiting for him at home, and then I thought of Anne-Marie and the kids, out there on their normal Saturday errands and then picking apples at the self-pick apple orchard, or petting domesticated wild animals at a petting zoo, or being read to at some library's reading hour, and it occurred to me that the world didn't need to be so big for just the four of us. I missed them badly and would have gotten in my minivan, we had two of them, and joined them at the petting zoo, for instance, except the minivan was low on gas, and I didn't know where the petting zoo was. "Anyway," Thomas said, shaking his head as if just waking up and trying to clear his head of a dream, "that's why I'm here. My shrink said I should find you and ask you to apologize for killing my parents." "Oh, I do apologize," as I said. "I'm so sorry." And I really was sorry, and at the time so happy that there was something I could do for Thomas after all those years. It is a rare thing to be allowed to apologize for something so horrible and final. It was like Abel coming back from the dead and giving his brother Cain the chance to apologize for killing him. "Oh, I'm so sorry for killing your parents," I said, and I was so full of penitence that I got down on my knees in a begging position. "I truly am sorry. It was an awful thing and changed too many lives, and I wish it had never happened." Thomas had his head down as I gave him my apology. After I was done, he kept it down as if waiting for more or contemplating what he had already been given. Finally, he raised his head and gave me a look that was grim and I knew meant trouble. "So that was your apology," he said. "That's it?" "Yes," I said, and then I said, "Sorry," for good measure. "That was an awful apology," Thomas said. His eyes looked about ready to pop out of his head and he clenched his fists. He was steaming, there was no doubt about it. Thomas looked exactly like those people you see on TV, those people whose loved ones have been killed and who then get to speak to their killers in court and who say the things to the killers that they think they need and want to say in order to get on with the rest of their lives and achieve some piece of closure, etc., only to find the words don't mean anything and aren't even theirs, really, and so end up feeling more desperate and grief-stricken and angry after they've spoken than they had before. Thomas looked an awful lot like that. "You're not sorry at all, he said. I am, I said, and I was, but didn't know what else I could do to convince him, because that's the trouble with being sorry. It's much easier to convince people you really aren't than you really are. You dick, he said. Hey now, I said, no need for that. You fucking dick, Thomas said, and he moved forward a little, and for a second I thought he was going to jump me, but he didn't. Maybe because he saw or smelled the dry sweat from my lawn mowing, or maybe because I was bigger than he was and had about 50 pounds on him. Thomas didn't know that he probably could have roughed me up and without getting even a little bit dirty. I could feel the old passivity coming on, could hear my heart beating, hit me, I deserve it and won't fight back, so hit me. But Thomas couldn't hear my heart, which is just one of the reasons I'm happy to have one. Instead, he took a step back, and his face took a step back too, and began to look contemplative, but still furious. "I wonder how many of your neighbors know that you're a murderer and an arsonist," he said. "I wonder if your friends know, your co-workers." "Well," I said, "I bet you haven't even told your family," he said. And when he said this, the world suddenly became blurry and squiggly lined, as though I were seeing it through extreme heat, and now I couldn't recognize it, the world, and be sure that it was still mine. "I know you're not sorry about killing my parents," Thomas said, "but you will be." I'll stop there. Thank you.